Joining us on the line now is psychologist, teacher and activist Dean Rudoy, who currently serves on the Board of Trustees for the Robert F. Kennedy Center for Justice and Human Rights. His book, Emissaries, Stories and Reflections, is described as a quiet book for chaotic times. It features 60 short memoir essays about his life experiences, with cameos from Paul Newman, Harry Belafonte and Edward Kennedy. Welcome to the show, Dean.
Well, thank you, Hannah. It's good to be here.
Oh, it's great to have you. Thanks so much for joining us. It must have been really, really wonderful putting this book together and reminiscing, was it?
You know, all my life I've been nostalgic, even when I was a child. Although I really don't know what a child would be nostalgic about. But I used to like to sit in the back of the boat and look at the wake, and sometimes would convince myself that the wake was determining my direction. And in some ways, it has. The stories that are in the book, the experiences that I've had, all of my reminiscences have pushed me forward. At the same time, of course, the future has pulled me forward. But I put these stories together and really thought, well, here's a handful of stories. And it was only after I finished the book that I realized what the book was really all about. And that is a journey of rediscovery of certain truths that I knew when I was a child. In a way that can be explained, if I can tell you a little story.
Yeah, please.
This is one of the stories at the beginning of the book. I was visiting some friends who have a 4-year-old son, and we were sitting in the living room, excuse me, and he was throwing a big red rubber ball around, and one of his throws went astray, and it bounced off the ceiling and hit a large potted plant in the corner of the room. And he ran to retrieve the ball, but on his way, he stopped at the plant and kissed its leaves. And we all observed this and wondered why. And I thought, well, he knows he has feelings, and he believes that the plant has feelings as well. And he felt a responsibility to make amends. He has an intuitive understanding of what I believe sages and mystics seek for years to understand, that everything is connected, that everything is whole. And of course, as time goes by, he will, as was the case with me, he will be educated, and he will learn to define things and discriminate between things. He will learn about all the opposites in this life. And all of that serves to divide up that which is whole. But he will always have within himself an understanding that everything is connected. Mm. So what I saw in his experience was the experience I had also as a child. You know that little indentation we have above our upper lips?
Yeah.
In the Jewish tradition, it is believed that before we're born, we know everything. And then an angel comes along and says, shh, and touches us just there. And we're born knowing nothing. But not exactly, because we do not have to teach a child that a rainbow is beautiful. They know it. They know it because they have the memory of rainbows within themselves. So the book is, yes, 60 short stories and reminiscences of my life, but there are also, along with the stories, certain lessons that I have learned along the way that I'm hoping will be of benefit to my readers.
Yeah. And why did you format the book like this, put it in 60 separate stories as opposed to writing a memoir, for example?
Oh, what a good question. I'm not sure if I have an answer for that. Maybe these are glimpses, you know? And in fact, these stories were written totally out of sequence. There's not sort of a linear through line.
Okay.
I'll tell you, basically, I dropped a bucket down into the well of my memory and pulled it up. And stories came up, and the sunlight hit the drops of water in the bucket, and more stories kept coming up. And then my process was to write the title of each story on a little 3x5 card with maybe one sentence about what the story was about, and lay them all out and try to put them together into categories. And eventually they just simply fell into place.
Fantastic. So that's how it ended up happening that way then.
That is, yeah, that's how it ended up.
So with regards to the different stories, as I mentioned in the introduction, can you tell us the story of Paul Newman and how he features in the book?
Yes, I will. That's a favorite story of mine. Back in the early 1970s, I served as education director of an organization in Washington, D.C., called SANE, S-A-N-E. And it was a arms control and disarmament group. And all of our material at that time, and by the way, this is the early 70s, so it's long before the digital age, and all of our educational materials were in printed form. But I thought it would be a good idea to put together a documentary film. And so I wrote it, and we started asking people if they would be available to narrate, and we contacted Paul, and he said yes. So he invited me to come up to Westport, Connecticut, which I did, and then we went to a studio in a little adjoining town called Weston, Connecticut, and we spent the day together recording this documentary. And along the way, during the day, we were eating bagels and drinking some beer, and the day went on and on. It was a half-hour script, and it took quite a bit of time to record it. And by the way, there were times when Paul would make an error or kind of skip a few words, whatever, and I'd have to stop him, which was a very difficult thing to do because this is, you know, a superstar, and who am I? But I would stop him, and I would say, Paul, can we pick it up from the top of that sentence or the top of the paragraph? And he would say, No, I'll just pick it up from the middle of the sentence. And I thought, how in the world are we going to be able to put this recording together? Because, again, this was pre-digital. We were working with quarter-inch tape. But the engineer was superb, and he ended up putting together a fine product. Well, by the way, when Paul and I arrived at the studio in the woods, we got out of the car, and there were some people walking down the steps of the studio, and Paul turned to me and said, I have to do some recording for these people first, and then we'll do our project. And he put his arm around me, and we walked toward these people, and we were all introduced, and he said to these people, this is my friend Dean. Now, we had known each other at that point for maybe 10 minutes, but he was so kind during the entire day. And then we finished up, and we drove back to the house in his Porsche. And we talked a lot about car racing because that was his passion, besides acting and directing. And we got out of the car, and I thanked him. And he said, why don't you join Joanne and I for dinner tonight? We're having dinner with Eli Wallach and Ann Jackson. And I was overwhelmed. you know how sometimes your cup runneth over? I mean, I was 21 years old. I didn't know how to respond to that kind of invitation. And
I hope it was with a yes.
I wish we could go back in time. I was scared. Well. I was scared. And I said, I'm so sorry, I'm not going to be able to. I have to get back to Washington, which was not true. And it is something I have regretted all my life, missing that particular opportunity. Many years later, I was sitting out on my parents' balcony in Florida, talking with my 92-year-old mom. And we were sitting there smoking cigarettes, believe it or not. And so I said to her, so, Mom, what's the last chapter like? We kind of had a habit of speaking very frankly with one another.
Mm.
And she took a drag on her cigarette, and she looked at me, and she said, no fear, no regrets. And I thought, well, what a wonderful thing to be able to say toward the end of your life.
Yeah.
And then sometime later, she passed away. And sometime after that, I woke up one morning and I thought, wait a minute. She wasn't just talking about herself. She was giving me an instruction for my life. No fear, no regrets. And that, of course, is linked to the Paul Newman story. Yes. I was afraid to accept his invitation. I did not accept it. And then I regretted it afterwards. So, you know, sometimes these lessons come out of order. If my mom had taught me that lesson before the Paul Newman experience, maybe I would have said yes, but oh well.
Oh, amazing. And what about Harry Belafonte?
Well, many years ago, when I was a child, my parents took a trip out to Las Vegas, Nevada, and they stayed at a very fancy hotel on the Strip, and they went to see a show with Harry Belafonte. And afterwards, they went into the casino, and my father liked to play craps. So there he is at the table, and he's playing, and he's losing. And sometime later, someone stands behind my father and says, how are you doing? And my father turns around, and it's Harry Belafonte standing behind my dad, asking him that question. And my father said, not so good. And Harry said, your luck will change now that I'm here. And it did. And suddenly my father started winning. So flash forward decades, and Harry and I are serving together on the board of the Robert F. Kennedy Center for Justice and Human Rights. And I told him this story.
Oh, wow.
And Yeah, it was wonderful. And he said, so that's how you got through college. And I said, yes, Harry. And by the way, thank you. So, again, you know, the passage of time, you know, everything's connected.
Mm.
And thank you for these questions, because they really illuminate one of the themes in the book, that everything's connected across space and time. Like right now, I'm in New Mexico, you're in Spain, and we're separated by 5,000 miles.
Mm.
But that very space also joins us together.
Definitely.
You know, it kind of requires you to tilt your head a little bit to see things in that way. And it's the same with time.
Mm.
All future expectations come from only one place, past memory. And all past memory were born in present moments. So residing within us is past, present, and future. Everything's connected. Everything is one.
Yeah.
But we lose sight of that, partly because of our education, which divides everything up and categorizes everything. But then there are these moments when emissaries appear, or when healing epiphanies occur, and we get this glimpse of, I believe, a very benevolent underlying pattern in our lives that connects everything together. And then we get these glimpses and we feel better. Also, we can become emissaries ourselves when we act out of love or out of compassion, and we blur the boundary of our separate self and help another person. You see, and connect together.
I have to ask you, I'm sure it's not a short answer because there's so many stories connected to the Kennedy family, but you have a huge long-standing connection to the Kennedys that started from you being age 11, handing out bumper stickers for JFK to yes. working for the campaign of Robert F. Kennedy. And a long relationship, don't you?
Yes, yes, I do. Very meaningful relationship over more than 50 years. Yeah.
And,
you know,
Go on.
Well, I was just going to say that when people ask me about the meaning of those relationships and they want a short answer, I say to them that it was John Kennedy who helped to shape my mind. Robert Kennedy, who helped to shape my heart, and Edward Kennedy, who helped to shape my conscience. They're very, very significant people in my life, yeah.
And tell me, can you tell us the story featuring Edward Kennedy in the book?
Yes. I was working for Robert Kennedy's campaign for presidency in 1968, and then we lost him. And that was in June. And I went back to school. I was going to Johns Hopkins University at the time. I went back to school in September, determined to create something at the university in honor of John and Robert Kennedy. And I created a lectureship. And I wanted Ted to give the inaugural address of that lectureship. It was to be one lecture every spring. And I contacted his office. I hand-delivered a letter. And he said that he would like to do it, but that he could not because of other responsibilities at the time. So with a boldness that surprises me today, I said, I will delay the lectureship until you're available. And it took a year. But eventually I received a letter from him saying, here are six dates, I'm available, you pick. So I picked one, and it was May 6th, 1970. So all preparations were made. The auditorium held about 1,200 people. I thought, well, we might get more. So I put speakers outside the auditorium, pointing toward this grassy quadrangle. 2 days before the lecture, on May 4th, 1970, National Guardsmen arrived at the campus of Kent State University at a peaceful demonstration of students who were demonstrating against President Richard Nixon's invasion of Cambodia. This was all during the Vietnam War, of course. Mm-hmm. And four students were killed, and many were wounded. So 2 days later, Ted was going to give this speech. And, you know, it was a time when the country was deeply divided, much like today. It was chaotic. And now, in a sense, the war had come home to our country. And we were lost. And we were seeking someone to lead us out of the darkness. So the auditorium was filled with 1,200 people, and another 4,000 people showed up and stood in that quadrangle that night, holding candles and listening to his impassioned plea for peace. A couple years later, I wrote a little book called Armed and Alone, The American Security Dilemma, and I asked Ted to write the introduction, and he was kind enough to do that. And we remained in touch over the years.
Wow, amazing, amazing stories.
Yeah.
Well, the book is full of them, and it's called Emissaries, Stories and Reflections, and it's by Dean Rudoy, who we've been chatting with. Dean, it's been a real pleasure having you with us on the show. Thank you so much.
For me as well. Be well.